Food Talk with Mike Colomeco is brought to you by Cento at cento.com, Colavita at colavita.com, and Wines of Portugal at winesofportugal.com.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey everybody, Michael Meko here. Food Talks the show, Heritage Radio Network. You know what you're listening to. Got a good show today. Four guests, so it's kind of a jam-packed hour. So we'll jump right in head first. Let's go. Guest number one here in the house. Let's go fast because we have 15 minutes for everybody. There's an oil that I had thought it was an iconic brand that I've been using forever, like in kitchens in New York in the 80s and at home since then. But apparently, I've been imagining that. But who knows? Were you a brand in France then?
Yes. My name is Matthew Latourangel.
I'm going to introduce you. Hold on. Let me do that. So, yes. Matthew. The brand is Latourangel, and you would notice I remember the packaging because it's in in that typical European style. It's in that kind of those squat metal containers that olive oil gets packed in a lot that are, what, 12 ounces, 16 ounces?
Yeah, 16 ounces, yeah.
16 ounces. But it's smart. Packing oil and metal's great because doesn't see light. It's like the best way to do it. I mean, Americans like glass and plastic, but metal is kind of the industry standard. But I know I knew your oils. I know I've used them before, and it must have been somebody who was importing them, and I was getting them at specialty stores or something.
Yes, it's possible. Yeah. Latourangel has been producing specialty oils, and especially nut oils, in Saumur and the Loire Valley since a long time. Maybe
and there's really good
ago.
Wines from that same region.
Oh, yeah. A lot of wines. Yeah. Yeah.
Saumur is one of our favorite regions. So you came on board in the aught years, in like 02, 03, to sort of launch the American side of the brand. Is that correct?
Yeah, basically, my father had a mill in France, in Saumur, and what we found is that the nut oils we could see in the U.S. were not that great, and we also saw that there were amazing nuts in California, walnuts, almonds, pistachio, pecans, and we said, well, why don't we produce it locally? And, you know, you got all this wine and all this stuff. There was this huge food trend over there. So I kind of packed my stuff and came to the U.S., to California, and next to Sacramento. Here we brought some roasting kettles and old presses, and we started producing the first batch of walnut oil. Latourangel walnut oil was produced in 2003, and you know, basically French style but local nuts, and that made quite a success.
Talk about how it's made, because these oils, for the most part, I've used your oils not as cooking oils but as either salad dressing,
yes,
or as finishing oils on the plate, but more specifically with green salads with the various high-toned vinegars you can get these days. Nothing like great oil. Olive oil is kind of my go-to, but great seed oils are fantastic. How do you make nut oils? Talk about that. Roast. How do you extract oil? Because, I mean, we know there's oil in nuts, but most of the nuts in America we just sort of eat them either raw or roasted, cracked open, and pop them in our mouth, chew, and they're gone. Mm. How do you extract oil from walnuts?
Well, you know, you like to talk about olive oil. You previously were explaining how it's made. Nut oils are slightly different because they're much more difficult to press. In order to get a nice flavor, because that's really what we do, we extract the oil, but our goal at Latourangel is to extract the flavor of the nuts. So what we do is at first we take the kernels, let's say the walnut kernel, we roast the kernel, and then we press it using an hydraulic press, not a centrifuge and this type of... So it's really the roasting that will actually bring out the flavor. Oh. And so that's why we said roasted walnut oil, because there is this really nice roasted walnut flavor in the Latourangel walnut oil. It's not refined, it's actually really flavorful.
And kind of a geeky question, but how much to make a 12-ounce container of walnut oil takes how many walnuts?
Basically, walnuts contain about 55% of fat. So you're not going to get everything out of it. So, you know, rule of thumb would be 2 pounds of nuts will give you maybe 16 fluid ounces of oil.
Okay.
So you have to figure out about twice the volume or the weight of the oil. That's if you work well.
And you've expanded. I'm looking on the back of this now because you guys were kind of sent me a bunch of samples. So you've got a whole bunch of grades of things. Tell me about the organic organic coconut oils? Because the one of them comes in a little plastic stubby, kind of a blunt jar, must be a solid. What are we using those oils for?
Well, actually, organic coconut oil has become really, really popular. I started basically with La Tour Angel promoting our own oils that we were producing, and we've been really successful. And very quickly, we found a lot of our artisan oil producers around the world that had amazing products, but not really the access to market. So we basically started importing these oils and packed them under our brand. Mm. Coconut oil, so the jar you're referring to is actually a fair trade product that is extra virgin. And so it's a coconut oil that is produced in the Philippines. And what they do is they take fresh coconut off the tree, they press the fresh meat, get the coconut milk, and then centrifuge this milk to extract the oil. So it's very, well, it sounds like technical, but basically the result is that it's incredibly fresh. And just like a good extra virgin olive oil, you want it to be as... Well, you want to keep all the nutrients alive in the product. So it's really when you press it, you don't want to eat, you don't want to have any process. The usual virgin coconut oil comes from dried coconut, whereas the extra virgin coconut oil that we sell is actually centrifuge. So truly there is never any eating element involved in the process, which makes a really big difference.
And the use for it would be frying, cooking, baking... What? How?
Yeah, well, a lot of people, obviously, you can cook with it many way, different ways, baking and different types of even for, you know, middle temperature. Actually, a lot of people are using coconut oil for body care today, for skin care as well, for hair care, because it's great for the skin. And so it's really funny because now what we see is that a lot of our customers are buying the oil, using it in the kitchen. They're delicious. But then they also use it in the bathroom for different stuff. So oils is very multifaceted.
Well, I know. I mean, the Mediterranean tribes have been using olive oil for everything in the world since they've been able to get it for, you name it, to eat it, put it on your hair, put it on your skin, put it on the wounds. All right, let's get to this. So one of the things that you sent me, which I was kind of like, what am I going to do with this stuff? You have these all-natural sprays.
Yes.
Talk about what they are, why they are what they are, and how I should use them.
Well, you know, sprays have become really popular because, you know, people get, you know, whatever, it's very functional. The issue we found is that a lot of these sprays are usually found in the supermarket shelves or aerosol. So basically, they contain 11% propellant.
Right. So if I'm buying, like Pam or something, right? I mean, that's something I would use for... The only time I ever use those things is, like, for baking.
Yeah.
Because they're really easy, and if I want to line an 8-ounce or a 12-ounce cake or 8-inch cake tin, it's just really easy to spray that oil. There's not too much of it. It's easy distribution. I never like the way it smells. I always wonder what's in that can.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is that's an aerosolized oil that is basically all air.
Basically it contains 11% petroleum product because it's butane and stuff like that. So
petroleum
basically,
petroleum product.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
Nice to know.
So yeah. So see, we wanted to do a spray, but we're looking for technology that would make us sell only 100% oil. So basically, what we found is that we put the oil in a bag, and then there is compressed air again. The bag. So whenever you press on the actuator, what comes out is 100% oil. And so that's one benefit. So you get the functionality of the spray. It's 100% oil, and the oil that comes out, or it's inside the container, is completely protected against oxidation. And we know
it's
that
in the bag and it's pulling a volume, so it's kind of like wine in a bag, the same idea.
Exact same thing. Back
same
in
technology.
The box. You got it. Yeah.
So that's who else does that for a spray oil? Is that like...
It's not very... you find a few brands, but basically... Yeah, we're embracing.
That's
this
really
technology.
Smart. So the gas is in the tin, the oil's in a bag within the tin, sealed.
Exactly.
And there's no. It's an anaerobic bag, so there's no contact with oxygen, with the gas, with anything.
So
I feel better using it then, because I'm like, what? This is like really good oil. That's Pam. Like, why am I going to use this stuff?
No.
But I knew you guys wouldn't do that because you're too good. You guys are.
Yeah. Well, 100%. Well, look, you know, we're passionate about producing oils, so it doesn't make any sense to blend it with chemicals. So we're trying to, you know, have a good technology there.
What's the difference? So you do nut oils. What are your finest specialty oils? Those are like avocado, pumpkin, oils from other sources?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we're bringing from Austria this delicious toasted pumpkin seed oil.
Yeah, they've always been, I know.
Oh, yeah.
My Austrian chef friends just, I remember like, they would be on a plate somewhere. There's not a lot of Austrian chefs in New York. There's a few. Mm-hmm. Seasonal, and Idi and the Wolf, and of course, Bettard now. And they've always loved those toasted pumpkin. They use pumpkin like crazy, and then the pumpkin oil. So that comes in from Austria.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so we have avocado oil is very popular right now. And so we have an amazing avocado oil that is coming from Mexico, most of it, a little bit from California as well, depending on what we found for avocados. And then
avocado oil you would use for what? Again, like a dressing? What's the taste of it?
Yeah, it has a slight taste of avocado, and so it's usually as a replacement to olive oil. So it's just to
you can use it as anything you want, salad dressings. You can finish fish on it on the plate. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah, it can take fairly high heat as well. So it's not like
it can't high smoking point.
Yeah, exactly. And another great product we just came up with is the organic sun cocoa, which is a blend of organic sunflower oil and organic coconut oil. And so that Tourangelle sun cocoa is really really cool product. Very high heat, totally natural flavor. It was designed for chef initially. And now it's in the retail place as well.
So that's because, I'm not the brightest bulb, but I remember getting that and going, what's a sun cocoa? Like, what is this? Because there was a whole bunch. There was like 15 tins of things to open. So that was designed originally for professional kitchens.
Basically, we were looking for we wanted to make the cooking oil that you could use for high temperature that would be 100% organic and that would be actually not too pricey. And so we felt organic sunflower oil refined with iolic was great. And coconut oil refined was also great. So we said, well, why don't we combine the two? And we sent that to a bunch of different chefs. They loved it. And that's how we came up with the product.
I remember years ago in Beaujolais somewhere, I think the town was Beaujolais, there's a guy named Jean-Paul Montegatero.
I know him very well, yes. Jean-Marc, yeah. Jean-Marc Montegatero is a great guy. Yeah.
Do you know him? He's really, I remember like friends of mine saying, you have to go see what this guy's doing. And he was kind of doing a very small version of what you do.
Oh,
he was sourcing nuts and seeds from around the world. He had a very old style stone, whatever that.
Yes. We have basically the same equipment. So we have these old presses that we actually brought two of these very old presses that.
What are they made out of? They're like it looks
cast
like
iron.
From Rome's cast iron.
It's insane. It weighs 2,500 pounds, and it's no bigger than you guys. I mean, it's really heavy. Yeah, Jean-Marc has three or four presses like that. So we just brought two to California. They just arrived. So that's really cool. We're super excited about these two old presses.
And he was, I was tasting his oils like, I'm cooked all my life. I'm a chef and I'm tasting his oils blind and it was just like poppy seeds. And I'm thinking, how the F do you make poppy seed oil? I mean, poppy seeds are like so tiny. It's like crushing an atom. Like, how are you getting oil out of these things, man? But they were like, it was like so obvious what they were. It was like the easiest blind tasting you could do because it was just, they revealed themselves to you every time you smelled them and put them in your mouth.
Oh, yeah.
French tradition, then.
Yeah, absolutely. Basically, Jean-Marc, where he's in Beaujolais, and then...
Beaujolais is the town. That's what I thought. I wrote down Beaujolais.
And then you go in the mountain. You follow the Loire River all the way to Angers, basically, the Loire Valley, and that's where you'll find all these nut oil producers. And there were we are like four or five left in France. And so we all know each other because we're part of the same industry and we try to collaborate. And so there are not so many, actually. So if you add our California meal now, we're basically six producers.
Yeah, I love the idea that you guys sort of had the gumption to realize that we had great raw materials here.
Oh, yeah.
Come to the States, open up a shop, which is what you did. So spell the name of the brand because I'm terrible at spelling things. La, and then Tourangelle.
Exactly.
In New York, where are we going to find you? Where are you in Whole Foods? Or
exactly.
Oh, you are.
Right. Whole Foods and many of other specialty food stores.
Yeah, we have a lot of those. Yeah. Fairways, Dina DeLuca,
exactly.
Citarella, all those guys.
Yeah, so we have good distribution. And then depending on the stores, you'll find different selections. Some will have more than others. But basically, we have pretty good distribution now in New York City as well.
And I always try and advocate people spending more on food and using less of it. Buy great meats and just don't eat big pieces of steak. Buy sustainable fish and just don't eat pounds of it. And the same thing with oils, because so much of the commercial oil is such... I mean, what Americans are eating, those hexane extraction oils, most of the seed oils, if people knew how they were made, I'm not sure they'd want to go near them. I mean, most of those seed extractions are just really kind of raw chemical extraction.
Usually they use hexane.
Hexane. A petroleum product.
Yes, it is. Yes, exactly. Yeah, so specialty oil is a great way to avoid that. So, yeah, look for flavor. If it has flavor, usually, it's not going to be as processed because usually it's the heavily refined product that will have actually been used with hexane and all this stuff. So, we are all for flavor. Enjoy good food, basically.
Thanks so much for coming out.
Well,
and you're
going to
be, for anybody that's listening in New York, you're going to be at the Fancy Food Show. Do you know your booth number?
Oh.
Whatever. Just La Tourangelle. Everyone that comes in gets a big book.
Come by the Fancy Food Show, you have to vote for our product because we actually are finalists best oil with our extra virgin coconut oil fair trade, La Tourangelle. And so you have to vote for it if you come by. We'd love you.
Matthew, thanks for coming out. La Tourangelle is the brand, really iconic French brand. Once you see the labels, you recognize them. They're unmistakable. They've done a great job marketing because that can sort of from 50 feet away tells you who the producer is. Looks like nothing else on the shelf, and the oils are great. Thanks for coming out. Enjoy New York this weekend. Have a great
Thank
time at the Fancy
much.
Food Show. And maybe I'll see you at the show.
Cool.
The
yeah.
Take
that's
care.
True.
Thank
okay.
you.
Thanks, sir.
Thank Folks, you so we're going to bring up some music. Don't go anywhere. We've got my next guest coming in. We've got an Italian winemaker who is... Giovanni Ascioni is his name. The grape varietals Pellegrello Nero. We're going to talk to him, taste his wine, and we're going to tease you because he makes so little that I'm probably the only one that's going to be able to taste it in the next 6 months besides a few restaurants that he sells to. So thank you guys coming in. We'll bring Giovanni in, bring up the music, and go live in another minute. Stay tuned for that.
This is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Ascione. I'm terrible. I'm a freaking American, obviously. A pleasure to have you. So this is really fun because you're bringing us a wine from Campania, but it's like a sub-region of a sub-region from what I can tell. The grape varietals, a varietal I had never heard of, but that's not... This in Italy, there's a few thousand grape varietals, I guess, and we haven't heard of... I mean, we've maybe heard of 40 or 50. The grape is Pellegrello Nero. There's also a Bianco.
Yeah.
But you don't make that.
No.
And your entire vineyard, you're talking about... Like 3 hectares, less than 3 hectares?
2 hectares and a half, yeah.
Talk about this varietal. Like, was it your family's plot of land? I mean,
No. Actually, I bought it. It's a beautiful vineyard. I was waiting for the chance to buy it because, believe me, it's the most beautiful vineyard in the area. And the area is, again, a beautiful area in the northern part of Campania, 40 kilometers from the sea. So it's a hillside, green, so pure, healthy. Think about small hills. Round hills, some of them with forests, some of them with vineyards. Mm. And there is one beautiful hill at the top of the hill with a part of them with a quite important slope, so going down, there is this 30 years old vineyard, mainly issued by Pellegrello Nero, which is the local variety, with some Rosso Vaglianico, another variety more popular, you know, in
Campania. And who was tending the vineyard prior to you buying it?
There was a guy that you used to sell to different wineries to sell grapes.
He would just sell the grapes.
Yeah. Just, and I don't know, but I think that he decided to sell just because for him, for his standards, the vineyard was getting too old, you know.
You're saying 30 years?
Now 25. But you know, looking for quantities, you know, if you stress a vineyard, so I bought a stressed vineyard that I'm caring, you know, trying to care, no, to. Following plant by plant, starting from pruning, and I'm having a very good response in terms of quality, no? Because the problem of Pallagrello Nero is that it's a beautiful variety, very noble with beautiful tannins, but the real problem is quantity. Yields are very low. So normally they preferred during 70s, 80s to plant, you know, different, right. For example, starting from Aglianico or international variety. It was lost, quite lost.
Which was true almost all over Italy, honestly.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, yeah. I was just in Sicily and we were talking to a lot of winemakers on that trip. And I mean, yeah. That was just, they were just producing, blending wines that they were sending in bulk to the continent to be blended for color and depth and extraction.
Exactly.
I mean, all the Nero d'Avila was just going
exactly
on a boat.
Exactly. And in this case, destiny was worse because yields were even lower. So just few families kept, no? Yeah. Some plants, some small vineyards just for family use because they knew it was the best in terms of quality. But the production was just for family, no? Now we are
developing. Yeah, yep.
That's going better.
So talk to me. I can begin to picture the place. Talk about the grapes themselves. 30 years isn't that old for a vine. I mean, a lot of vines hit their production peak at around 30 some years, and will continue making great grapes for 40, 50, 60, 70. I've been in vineyards where the vines are pushing 80 or 90. Do you expect these will have that kind of longevity? Do we know?
Now, yes. But, you know, I think that the previous owner and most of them in that area, growers in that area, they wouldn't plant Pallagrello if they would know the yields level, no? So low.
So the yield is what you're saying. The yield is low.
It is a problem because the first part of the first three gems of each branch are not with a bunch. With a grape, so you have to have a longer branch. No? That's why yields are so low. About the characteristics of Pallagrello Nero. Pallagrello Nero is so noble because it's full of polyphenols, a huge quantity of polyphenols, but they are very silky, always. So quantity of tannins, but also quality. No? That's rare. And it's a God big gift because you have this amount of tannins ready very early, end of August, first of September. So even if it's a late variety, so you can decide the moment of your harvest, following your ideal wine, just following the ratio between acidity and sugar, not waiting for ripening of tannins.
Right.
You know? This is a gift, you know, definitely. And if you look for elegance, for a new wave of Southern Italian red that in the past have been sometimes sort of caricatural, I don't know, they were extreme, they were too similar to certain stereotypes, to have alcohol and alcohol concentration. You can add also new oak,
like California Cabernet.
So
and this sort of big, broad-shouldered, lack subtlety, people kind of like that full of jammy fruit. I mean, am I misspeaking, right? I mean, that was the sort of stereotypical in a way. This is much, much more restrained. Are you practicing organic bio?
Yeah. I decided to, but it's a longer answer. I'll try to be short, but I don't like official, you know, official patents, official stamps. But 2 years ago, I decided to start the conversion in organic, the official conversion in organic, because I was already. So I make my documents, no?
Right.
I made my documents. So next year, I'll have the official certification, but I will not put on the label. But I want to have it just to be free to say what I think.
But you're making natural wine, so the yeast for fermentation is naturally occurring on the grapes.
Yeah, you know the approach. I work as a crazy in the vineyard. I have a.
You work the vineyard yourself.
Yeah. I have an Excel file. Each square is a plant. I work bunch by bunch from May to the harvest. So in the cellar, the work is, you know, it's a little. I have a longer maceration, but just to have less concentration. I mean, I don't crush the cap. So like you know, like a tea bag. I prefer to leave the tea bag for a longer time, not touching it, instead of to have a shorter time squeezing it and having you know a maceration not elegant.
But it's not a carbonic maceration.
No, grapes.
They're crushed.
Absolutely. I pump over. In the peak of maceration every 3 hours,
right.
To give oxygen, to yeast, to eat,
right.
To work.
Right.
Then at the end of maceration, just 13 for 36 for 48 hours of decanting, then I move for gravity to tonneau, French tonneau of 500 liters for malolactic already. That's why you don't feel oak. And after I rake, obviously, after the malolactic fermentation, and then I don't rake anymore. I don't filter. I don't clarify. Yeah, but it's not for an ideological approach. But, you know, I have no press. I don't press the wine. So I just have, we say, the vino fiore, the flower of wine. So the best part of also in terms of tannins. So why you have to put away something, you know, with a clarification? I just go to bottle.
And nothing. The oak is a mix of old and new?
Yeah, there is a more or less, it depends on vintages, but more or less 2025.
And you've only had 3 vintages. This is, we're drinking the 13?
No, I started on 08.
08, okay. All right.
So this is the sixth.
Sixth vintage, okay. I mean, this is like baby.
Yeah, don't tell me, because for me it's a century.
That's right, you have to be there every day.
But,
And let's just get, this is a funny, I mean, I would be remiss if we didn't get to this. Your total production is how many cases total production?
I tell you in bottle because I wrapped in bottle on the back of the label, and the 13 is my record. The production record is 7,810 bottles, not cases, bottles.
Yeah, it's like 600 and some odd cases.
640 maybe.
How many of those make it to the United States?
70.
But you got to do more. Yeah. On behalf of everyone in America, we are the only country on the planet Earth that's increasing our per capita consumption of wine. The only one. America keeps going up every year. And I want to make a special case in point for New York. Because people ask me all the time, I'm with winemakers all the time, they talk about the American market, and I say there is no such thing. There's New York, Chicago, San Francisco, Los Angeles to some extent. There's some great master somms in Vegas, whatever. But New York's its own animal. I mean, New York needs more of your wine.
But actually, I'm increasing the allocation to New York. I spread my production over 20 countries. So I'm get crazy. But it has been for me a way to travel, thanks to my wine. You know,
it's and we should talk about the wine. So in the glass, I mean, it's pretty. I mean, this is new wine. And I don't have a whole lot in this glass, but it's pretty deep ruby. On the nose, and I'm still waiting for it to blow up. We just opened the bottle. I mean, I would have loved if we had decanted this an hour or two ago, right? So it's still kind of revealing itself. But, I mean, there's ripe red fruit, plum, right? Little bit of berry, but like blackberry, plum. I'm not getting licorice. Maybe tobacco? I mean, it's really interesting. But what's the most amazing thing is the tannins, you're right, are completely silky. And this is a 13.
Yeah, and there are a lot. I mean, you know, also in terms of aging potential, no? It's very high. Last Monday, I had my first vertical ever here in New York City, so I was so surprised. Yeah, and we started from eight. Looked like just bottled. You know, the aging potential is very high of this kind of. Palagrade, variety, you know.
Well, thank you so much, Giovanni, for coming in. It's really a pleasure to meet you. Your passion comes across.
Thank you to you.
You love what you do. Just send more to New York, please, please, please. The name of the grape variety. Give us the name of your... Okay, the name of the grape is Pellegrino Nero. They also make a Bianco, but he doesn't make one. But your bottle is called... What's the name of the bottle?
Nanni Coppè. And the name of the wine, Nanni Coppè, is the name of the winery.
Okay.
It's my nickname when I was a child. And the name of the wine is Sabbie di Sopra il Bosco.
You'll find it on the Heritage website. We'll have it attached to today's show. Thank you so much for coming in. We've got to run. We're going to take a quick spot with some commercial breaks for people that make this show possible and other shows on the network. Then I'm going to be back with Robert Sietsema. Good enough. The many, 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 many years, the revered and respected food critic for The Village Voice, who has since decamped The Voice and is now hanging his hat at Eater, New York, where you can find his work all the time. We're going to talk about some of his recent posts. So stay tuned for some New York food talk coming up right after this.
Thank you, guys.
So if you want to make a great tomato sauce, where do you start? You start with great canned tomatoes. And what are the best? What's the gold standard? What do the best Italian restaurants use, you think? San Marzano tomatoes from southern Italy. You know, I've heard of San Marzano tomatoes, loved them, heard the whole legend thing, knew they were delicious, but I wanted to go visit the region. So sometime back, I don't know, 06, 07, we went to San Marzano in the middle of the packing season in August. They've got a really long growing season. Starts early spring, April, May, and runs all the way through October because the weather down there is beautiful. Beautiful. You're along the coastline of Naples there in the shadows of Mount Vesuvius. And these are really small family farms, really small, like a half an acre apiece. And that's how they make a living, is harvesting these tomatoes. But what makes them great is the typicity of everything, the style of the tomato. It's kind of a long tomato with a really thin skin, super fleshy, super sweet tasting off the vine. We can Cento San Marzano tomatoes in the prime of the season, which is August. They just slow production down, hand pick everything. Those little basil leaves, yeah, they're all put in there by hand as well. It is the best canned tomato I've ever had, and you're going to love them too. There's a reason chefs love these things. They're San Marzano authorized from the beginning. The factory gets inspected every year. Hey, you want to make great tomato sauce at home? Start with great tomatoes. Cento San Marzano. That's what I use. Hey, folks. Mike Colomeco here. Years back when I had my own restaurant, I had to figure out what kind of oils to use, you know, try to make money in the restaurant business. So, you know, the most expensive oil wasn't the choice, but I had to use an oil that was great, an oil that I would use at home and also for my customers. Came upon
Colavita olive oil, which to this day still stands head and shoulders above everybody in that extra virgin category in the supermarket shelves. So much of the extra virgin category is dominated by labels that sound like they're Italian. You know, they end with an O or something like that. But the truth is they're tank farm blends that come out of Italy, but what's in the jar or the can is oils from all over the world that are just spot on price. It's commodity oils. Colavita is the only one that's an extra virgin that's 100% Italian origin traceable. It's a great company. They really built their brand on the U.S. market. They get the U.S. market. So if you're looking for a super extra virgin olive oil, use the one that I've been using for years on my table at home and in my restaurants, wherever I was hanging my chef's toque. And that would be Colavita Extra Virgin. True Italian, great oil. So my first trip to Portugal was 2013. It was a wine trip. A bunch of us flew over and toured the country top to bottom. Fell in love with the place. The food, the wine, the scenery, everything. Had to come back, which I did in 14 to film. And this time, 8 days in country, top to bottom again. Food, wine, surfing, what's not to love? If you've never been to Portugal, it's an extraordinary place. Buffered on one side by the Atlantic Ocean, you've got great seafood, great wines growing in all those regions. You go a little inland, you've got more great food, incredible wine country. Of course, Port is the birthplace of ports up the Douro. But my takeaway was, I thought I'd had a lot of varietals. I could keep a list of 130, 135 varietals I've had over my life. Portugal has 250 of its own indigenous wine varietals. And they're killer good. A lot of them growing there for centuries. It has some of the oldest viticulture in Europe. The sparkling wines from the Bijada, the great reds coming down south from those regions. What's not to love? Crisp whites, beautiful full-bodied reds, port wine, sparkling wine. So if you're not familiar with the wines of Portugal, next time you stop by at your local wine store, ask about them. I love them. I'm drinking a lot of them these days, and I think you will too.
Hello, this is Mark Ladner from Del Posto, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Oh, Liz, I like it better when you have the singing girls chorus. Hello, this is Mark Ladner from Del Posto. Yeah, I'm better than Barry White. Okay, all right, I'll let Mark. He's a hell of a chef. All right, Robert Seitzman in the house. Did I have you on the radio when I was at Food Talk at WOR? I must
about
have.
A million times.
Did I? Okay.
I can't believe you've forgotten.
No, but I just felt like it should have been more.
That
million and
creepy
one.
Creepy kind of tower studio there, kind of way, way downtown.
Yeah, those creepy people. Like, those are creepy people that work there.
Yeah, yeah. Creepy.
Yeah, they were all like heavy-duty conservative. Yeah, look, they canned me and they put Glenn Beck in my spot. That says it all.
Yeah.
But I used to give them shit, so I kind of deserved it. You can't shit on the station that you're at. That you're broadcasting for, not when they paid you. Anyway, great to have you here. So, quick introduction. For many, many years, I was a huge fan from a distance because I didn't know you. I would read the Village Voice religiously. Always has. Really, my mom used to actually get the Village Voice when you were a baby. Back delivered, like for some reason, when we were kids, I used to read it. And there used to be dirty pictures in the back. I remember that. That was the best part. Yeah, 13, 14, dirty pictures. I'm taking that with me. But you were at The Voice for how many years?
20 years.
20 years. And what I thought you did so well was, you know, let sort of the Times and the Adam Platts at New York Magazine fight over, is Bernadette Astill 4 stars or is it 3 stars? There is per se. Let them do. You just said, you know what, there's all of this great food around the city being cooked in Manhattan and in the outer boroughs, and a lot of it's ethnic, and a lot of it's you've never heard of, and I'm going to kind of make that what I do. And I remember there was a little thin book that I probably published a few times that was like The Shape of Zagat, but infinitely more valuable and better, that was like Robert Seitzman's Guide to New York Ethnic Eating?
It had a title so long that I can't even remember it myself. And there were 4 editions that came out between 1994 and 2004.
Okay.
And as subsequent editions came out, we made it kind of smaller and smaller, but with thinner pages and more listings, so you could literally put it in your pocket.
That's what I have, and it was great. I mean, it was so great because you would just discover these places that I don't. How? So I'll just ask you, like, by way of in-house shop, how did you hear about these places? You just have a network of foodie friends that live everywhere that do what you do with the same passion?
The secret is that if you do this for a living and you spend all your time doing it, you just basically wander around like an itinerant food critic looking for places. And sometimes you just close your eyes and put your finger at a stop on the subway map where you haven't been in 5 years. You wait till you're really, really hungry. And then you get on the subway and you go there. And if you're like really famished, you know, on the other hand, if your objective is never to have a bad meal, then, you know, you're usually faced at any subway stop with like 10 different places, and you kind of go in and give them the sniff test and then pick whatever you want. And the food is invariably fantastic.
Which is one of the great blessings of New York City, because I think we have the most dynamic food scene on the planet. And a big part of it is that, yeah, sure, we have the high end, and we have all that stuff locked up pretty well. But the ethnic diversity, because of the city itself, because we're such a melting pot, still are, always seem, I think we always will be, that every new wave of immigrants brings something with them, which leads me, I'm going to just jump all over the board today. So I had somebody here the other day, I know who it was. It was Ryan Sutton, your classmate there at Eater, who was telling me about Venezuelan food that you were telling him about. And I was just in Peru earlier this year. And so Venezuela is a tough place to be right now if you're a business person.
Well, that's why we've had this efflorescence of Venezuelan restaurants here. We had our first one like 12 years ago, and now we have 20.
And there's 2-1 Essex Street, which is, I live on Grand, just right, south right. of Delancey. So now you're talking about, like, I mean, I shop on Essex all the time at the market. So now you're talking about, like, I can walk up to, like, between Rivington and whatever that next one is. On, like, 2 blocks north of Delancey, there's going to be, within a couple hundred yards, 2 really good Venezuelan restaurants.
Right, and there's also, there's a Bolivian restaurant there, too, and there's all sorts of South American restaurants. But, you know, with a Venezuelan, it's just a matter of their economy, you know, going into the toilet and all of the strife and stuff. And what you have there is that patacón pasal.
Tell me about that. So patacón's a sandwich or something?
Yeah, it's from the western part of Venezuela. It's a sandwich. You know, they never had a lot of cheap wheat there the way that we do in the Midwest or the way that they do in Europe. So they have to make everything out of plantains and everything out of corn. So one of the things they do is that they've turned these like fried green plantains into the halves of a sandwich. And so that place specializes in these crazy sandwiches. And it takes a while to learn how to eat them because, you know, you try to bite down on the crisp plantain
and the inside
squirt out the other side.
How do you eat them? Knife and fork?
Very carefully. Sometimes I try to hold the opposite edges together with my hands so that it squirts in my direction down my mouth.
That's hysterical.
Yeah. And they have a hamburger that they make that way, too. So, you know, there's a lot of fusion going on there.
Tell me about, so I had the barbecue critic for Texas Monthly in here 2 weeks ago.
Daniel Vaughn.
Right before the Big Apple barbecue, he was here with Tim Love and somebody else. And he was telling me that, you tell the story. He's landing at the airport. And then he's telling you that he's got to be here in the studio with me at like 4 o'clock. And you talk to him at some point in between and say, we got to go to the Bronx to it. You tell the story.
Well, you know, one of the things about that critics like to do when they get together for different parts of the country is they go on these marathons. And I've done it with probably 20 critics from other cities. And what happens is that they get here and they hit the ground running. You know, they'll usually have a radio appearance or a TV appearance like 2.5 hours later. So the trick is, how many places can I visit within 2.5 hours? And in his case, he arrived. I met him at the hotel. We got in an Uber and went up to Riverdale. He's obsessed with New York pastrami. It's the one thing that you can't really get anywhere else in the country in exactly the same form. And we went up to this ancient place from the 50s called Liebman's Kosher Deli, where they have some of the best pastrami. And true to the pastrami maker's art, they don't tell anyone how they do it. As a matter of fact, they smoke it themselves, but they won't say where. They won't say where they get their briskets. But we went there, and he was almost in tears. It was so good.
So Liebman's.
Liebman's, yeah, up on, what, 235th or 238th?
Is it a subway stop? Or?
Unfortunately, it's a ways away from the subway stop, which is why we had to take the Uber. But it's really only, it's about maybe, I would say, half a mile or three-quarters of a mile from the one stop at 232nd Street.
Liebman's in the Bronx. Yeah, he came back raving about this place. And I know I've read you writing about it before. Were they in the hot dog issue that you did? Do they have a great hot dog?
Yeah, but the most notable thing, they have a wonderful hot dog.
Because Katz's, too. Katz's still has some good pastrami. But I totally agree with you. I mean, I would go in Katz's sometimes. Because, I mean, I don't eat a lot of breakfast and lunch just because I don't know, have a weird diet and I eat a lot of dinner. Worst thing you could possibly do, but that's what I have to do for a living. But I, every so often I would get off. I would take the F train. I would get off, not my stop, which is Delancey Essex, but I'd go up to 2nd Avenue.
Right, right.
And just say, I got to do it. And I just walk in. There's never a line for the hot dogs. And you just tell them you want a, if you want a really crispy one, there's going to be one that's been spinning on that thing for a while.
Oh, absolutely.
Or you can tell me one. And they'll just, it's like a couple of bucks. I don't know what it is, but like super hot dogs. And they have the garlic one that's really great, the big fat one.
Noble verse. Yeah, yeah.
But Katz's hot dogs,
well, you
are
know
sick.
What the dirty secret about Katz's is? If you look at the side, it says Fabrikwurst. That means sausage maker. And long before they were making pastrami, they were making sausages. I mean, that's the reason that Katz's is there, and that's why the Nobelwurst and the hot dogs are so damn good.
Yeah, they're insanely good. And I'm glad you shout out to Gray's, because the original Gray's is damn good on 72nd Street. It's one in Harlem, too, if
well,
it's
when
still
we
there.
Lost our West Village one, or we're actually Greenwich Village one, we were so...
Yeah, on 6th Ave, right?
Oh, yeah. It was so great. It was one of the places that held out against canned chili for the longest time. They only served what we in New York put on our hot dogs, which is mustard, sauerkraut, and this crazy Greek onion relish invented about 100 years ago.
Yeah, I just do mustard myself. I'm really old school.
That's great.
Tell me about this. You just wrote about it. This little, and again, this is like, to credit to you sort of sniffing stuff out, it's a little place in Sunset Park. And Sunset Park's funny because it went from being initially Nordic, Swedish, Scandinavian.
That's right.
To being very kind of Puerto Rican and then Chinese like crazy. It's a great little Chinatown on like
Sunset Park, yeah, on 8th Avenue.
On 8th Avenue, yeah, yeah. That's some of the best Chinese food I've had anywhere in the city. And now I guess there's a Mexican that bubbling up. Tell me about Puebla de los Angeles.
It sounds
so it's like
a
bodega. It's like a bodega.
It's a bodega. And that's the way that all of our new crop of southern Mexican taquerias arose. They began when Mexican immigrants took over bodegas from Puerto Ricans and from Dominicans. They had the same stuff there, but gradually they added Mexican groceries. And then when they got enough Mexican groceries, especially botanical things like, you know, the various southern Mexican herbs that they use, when they started getting those, they said, hey, why the hell don't we start making tacos? And they put a taco counter in the back, and a lot of these places morphed into delis where they were serving, you know, tacos and quesadillas, and especially those hand-formed masa boats like huaraches and sopas. And pretty soon we had just astonishingly good Mexican food.
Can I ask you, and I hate to do this, but we are on the record. What do you think? I've been to it, and I really like what he's doing, Stupak's El Pastor.
You know, I like his regular taqueria in the
West Village which is
a
near
lot
you.
More. It's fantastic. The El Pastor, it's fine, but it's not going to make me kind of grab my ass and go running over there.
Yeah, the West Village one's classic. That's like on West 4th.
Yeah, it's great, and he does some amazing things there. Like he does a house-cured pastrami with mustard seeds in a taco, and it's killer.
And he makes that pastrami with short ribs, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, he's one of our ballsiest chefs. I mean, even when he fails, he's good.
He was the uber pastry chef with Grant Achatz and Wiley.
And WD-50,
WD-50, then he just bails and does this. I'm like, whatever. All right, we've got I hate to do this. We had 4 guests today. It wasn't supposed to happen, but I only thought we were going to have 3, which is a lot for me. Robert, can I get you back in the fall?
You bet. Thanks, Mike.
We have a lot to talk about. Yeah. Robert Seitzema, you can read his work all the time. It's almost daily posts at Eater New York City. There's a whole backlog of them. If you haven't seen his books in print, grab a copy of them if they're there. He's great. He is one of the great authorities for New York dining.
I have a new book, too, called New York in a Dozen Dishes that just came out.
Congratulations.
HMH. Yeah.
Congratulations. I think I met your agent the other day somewhere, one of those nights, maybe at a barbecue thing or something.
David, yeah, I'm sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right, now I got 2 guests coming. We're going to bring up some music, and I have 2 friends of mine, Chef King from Kuma Inn and Umanam, who is now doing the food for Jimmy Carbone's Jimmy's 43. We're going to talk about that, about Jimmy's 43, about how that's morphed from a beer hall with great food to a full liquor licensed great beer hall, now with Philippine food courtesy of King. Stay tuned. In a minute, they'll be with me.
So much.
Good to see you.
You too. It's great to see you.
So tell me about how this whole thing came about, man. Jimmy's 43 has been on 7th Street.
7th Street between 2nd and 3rd.
Between 2nd and 3rd for a long time. In the East Village, a long time, right down the street from McSorley's. You always had a great, you were known for beer events, having completely great beer selection. Bottles on tap, stuff that almost nobody had. Your kitchen space was limited, but you did what you could do with the food. You've gotten by on that. You recently expanded last year, Full Liquor, Community Board. You cleared all those hurdles. Then the damn buildings blew up on that corner, which was, I mean, horribly tragic because a bunch of people died. It's just horrible. I mean, so that whole story is just one long, sad story. Business interruption for you for a long time. But as you came out of it, there was this great announcement that somehow or other, you two guys, who've obviously known each other forever, said, let's change the kitchen and let King do his stuff at my place.
I just want to say that King is the kitchen whisperer. If you ever saw the movie Tampopo about the...
I have seen Tampopo.
Yeah, the Japanese noodle shop, Japanese cowboy pulls into town and turns it all around. I've never worked as closely with King. I knew he was going to be great, but when he came in, I mean, the backstory is that, you know, we've worked together on a lot of things, Pig Island and been friends. And
that's where we met, Mike, Pig Island.
And Days of Taste, there was a program in the public schools. That's actually how we met about 12 years ago. But the plan was King was going to come in anyways, whether we had the disaster or not. We've been talking about it since the winter. And the brief intro is that, you know, King basically came in, and you expect, you know, all these chefs to come in and throw pans and scream. But King comes in, and he's like the kitchen whisperer, and he's like changing ingredients and working with our cooks. And it's been an awesome experience. But I kept thinking about that. I was like, it's like Tampopo, man. It's happening here at Jimmy's number 43.
So tell me about the food you're doing, King.
Yeah, you know, I love Jimmy's Place, the beer. You know, I love beer.
And it's subterranean. Just the whole vibe. The idea that you're stepping down. I remember the first time I went there, I'm like, where is it? Because there's like something above it. There's like a bar. And I'm like, right. where is this joint? You know, and I'm kind of stupid anyway. So I'm like, oh, man. And I don't know how to use my smartphone. So I'm like, it probably took me a few minutes to figure out. You got to walk down the steps to the basement, dude. That's where it is. That's where 14 is.
That's right.
Yeah.
So anyway, this place is groovy, so keep going.
Yeah, it's good. It's different for me. You know, Kumin's on the second floor, so now we're in a basement.
Yes.
No, but what I love about it is the beer, and now he has bourbon, and I love bourbon. And
I think I was drinking bourbon last night. It's kind of becoming a regular thing, unfortunately, for my liver.
And, you know, the food that we're doing over there, pretty much the beer pairs very well with the food that I do.
For sure.
And you remember this.
You and I, we were in the Philippines, man. We were 2.5 weeks, it seems.
Yep. So, you know, we're doing adobo chicken wings. We're doing lumpia. Yeah, the spring rolls.
Yeah, lumpia, buddy Neil's baby.
All that fun stuff. And then I introduce a few new things onto the menu, like to keep it more bar-oriented. I'm doing it's called Halo Halo Fries. And remember Halo Halo, the
ice cream? So Halo Halo is an ice cream thing. So I read this. So Halo Halo is this weird Philippine thing that you have to figure it had to do with, like, the American occupier. Because it's a mashup of, like, candy and ice cream and hard things and soft things. And then to eat it, you just sort of – it's put in, like, a big sundae tall glass.
Right.
And to eat it, you just kind of have to smash the shit out of it with a long spoon.
Exactly.
And have at it. There's no delicate thing to this.
No, it's not.
So what are Halo Halo Fries?
And it's a shaved ice dessert. Yes. Halo Halo Fries are basically, well, I have fries, and then I put on some, I saute some ground beef with Thai chilies and black beans, and then put that on top, a little Kewpie mayonnaise, some Bonito flakes. And it comes out on the table, and you kind of, like you said, mash it up and start
to
get
it.
Filipino poutine, man.
Yeah.
That's what it sounds like to me. That's what it sounds like to me.
So we have that. I put in a burger the other night. So a burger instead of, we do our own pickles there, the achara. You remember from the Philippines, a little green papaya, carrots, put that on top. And I made a mayo with sriracha, sweet chili.
King's sensibility is amazing. It's also because, first of all, he's doing some traditional flavors and ingredients. Like Kathy Irway, who's our buddy, she was in and did her own cookbook for Food of Taiwan, a little dinner a few weeks ago. And she came in and she looked on the shelf and said, I can tell that King's already here, because she pointed out the different ingredients that he brought in. It's kind of fun.
But yeah, so we're doing things like that. You know, the bar used to have, I guess, like sliders and fries, and now we have fish sauce, soy sauce, oyster sauce, lots of pork.
But, you know, and from this process, too, like learning about the Filipino culture, you know, you're friends with like Philippine Chamber of Commerce, and I'm learning about the culture, and they say it's a culture of drinking and eating, and I'm like, that's what I'm about. You know, to me, that's a, like, whether you're German Gemütlichkeit or, you know, in Spain or Italy, cultures of eating and drinking, that's what I like.
Are there any other cultures that matter? What are the rest of them?
Well, there's some just drinking cultures.
Brooding and depression. You know? You're not an eating and drinking culture, folks. I'm sorry, you've signed up for the wrong team. Is the kitchen still the same? Last time I was there, it was like four electric burners.
I was able to convince Jimmy to get some new equipment.
Am I exaggerating? Last time I was there, it was like two were lower and two were higher. And I'm like, dude, there was like a double door convection oven. And like, okay, so I can see where this could be a challenge.
It's a challenge. It's still the same. But actually, it worked out for the better because if Jimmy had gas after all those explosions, he would still not be open, and he may not be here as well. That's right. So they shut him down, but it was just under a month.
Because the buildings, just if you don't know, I mean, I'm sure it made national news. There was three contiguous apartment buildings on the corner of 2nd Avenue and the 7th that went down. And the wall that is the wall that you see now from 2nd Avenue, which is the only exposed wall on that side, that's the wall of your building.
Yeah, right behind that.
So the explosion and the fire raged literally at the building next to yours. And with the demolition, now your wall kind of makes you, for a moment, the corner.
The corner, yeah. But we got, you know, basically to save our building, the FDNY was great, but they hosed down our building for like 24 hours.
Just to make sure, because there's a lot, right, there's heat in the walls.
All that water went into MySpace. So that was our big issue, that we had at one time at least 12 inches of water in the space. Ceilings came down. All the ACs were busted. We're still dealing. We covered it up and we were able to get open, but we're still dealing with all that stuff.
Carbone, dude. I mean,
but that's why I was there, King, man.
I was
Come
there
on.
One night for a bacon tasting years ago, a bacon and cheese pairing, when the fire department shut you the F down. I remember. Remember
that's
that
a
night?
A lot of history.
I was there that night. I'm like, are you kidding me? Catch those guys. We're doing stuff, and man. You know, come back later. What did he do wrong? Who do we got to pay?
Michael, do you know who was there that night? The host of the bacon tasting was our good friend and
R.I.P.
dearly departed Josh Zersky.
I know.
There's a lot of history in that space. A
lot of history in that space is right. So will we see? I know I've seen it on Facebook. From time to time, you do a special at Kuma of Lechon. Might there be a Lechon night at Jimmy's?
Oh, yeah, baby. Sundays. Regular thing after the summer.
Yeah, so that's something to look forward to. I mean, I'm looking forward to summer, honestly. But then once I'm in the middle of summer, I'm looking forward to fall, because at some point I'm sick of sweating and heat and getting tired of eating corn every night and fresh tomatoes. So let's get to the next season. But it's so nice. So when I come back from Cape May, and I'll be back here in the fall, Sunday nights, I'll come up
Sunday
early,
nights.
Lechon night, which is this beautiful suckling roast pig that you can't beat that stuff.
No, it's all good stuff. Suckling
right
roast pig,
labor.
Some
and
pickles.
We tried it out for Father's Day. We did a Lechon special, and it was great. I mean, King makes an awesome Lechon. It's like a suckling pig. The skin's perfectly crisp, and so we're sold. But we're going to wait. As soon as Sunday after Labor Day, we'll have the Lechon every Sunday.
So this gives you now three outposts in the city.
Three.
How's Bed-Stuy?
It's okay. You know, Bed-Stuy's Bed-Stuy. It's do or die. We're doing it.
Okay. And how's our friend Neil doing with Lumpy on Greenwich?
Neil, he's good. He just...
Did he do something downtown?
He did. He just opened up a little pop-up at the Seaport.
Okay, so he'll run that seasonally.
Yeah, so that's a seasonal thing. He has that, and he has the shack. So, yeah, everybody's doing well. You know, and I know another Filipino spot I heard opened up somewhere in the East Village.
Wow.
Next to us.
So, a couple of them.
Jeepney's been there a while.
Oh, they've been there. And then another one just recently.
Ugly Kitchen's been there, too. That's the other one. Ugly's been there.
Those are friends.
And then there was that weird Hawaiian place that got reviewed. I mean, it was a funny week for the Times. Yeah.
Right. That one, yes. And then now we have Tito King's at Jimmy's 43.
Tito King's Kitchen at Jimmy's number 43. Yeah.
So tell us what Tito King's means. What's that mean?
Uncle King's. Uncle King's at Jimmy's 43.
All right.
You know, that's it's great. I love it over there because I get to do fun stuff, you know, creative and not worry about
It's a like beautiful space. There's the main bar. There's a couple of other dining rooms and event spaces. It's New York history. You're stepping off of one of the great streets in the city, in the heart of the village. So you have all those beers still. Now you got a full liquor license. Concentration on bourbons, whiskeys, ryes, anything?
You know, New York and indie spirits. So we've got, like, last night, Nicole Austin, who's the master blender at Kings County Distillery, she came and did a little slow food, spirits tasting. And we always did things like beer dinners and other types of tasting. So we're going to build everything around King's Food. So if we do a whiskey dinner, it's going to be with King's Food. If it's a beer dinner, it's going to be with King's Food.
I also brought in some calamansi. So now I'm doing, instead of a Moscow mule, we have a Manila mule.
Man, I remember those little calamansis. By the time we were gone, we were all missing. We were putting them on everything. I think on my flight out, when I was waiting in the lounge at the Manila airport, I was squeezing them into my gin and tonics, getting my last calamansi fix of the day with gin and tonic, because it was midnight, and it was the beginning of a 48-hour trip home. Well, longer than that, I think, actually. We'd been up all that day.
Double black. That's all I got to say.
Double black, business class, upstairs on the A380 Airbus, baby. Emirates Air. We got to know those bartenders, man. They were on the way over, they were making us drink equal parts water and scotch at one point. Concerned for our health, they were. It didn't put a dent in the scotch drinking, though, did it?
No. So, Michael, you're big, since you spent some time in the Philippines with King, are you really into the Filipino food now?
We had a ball, man. We had so much fun. It was a great trip. It was great. I mean, I wish it could have been longer. I wish we could have shot Chef Gene on day two. You know, there's always ups and downs of these trips. But King was a blast. Neil was a blast. The food was great. And I got to meet Sir John Arcea.
He gives his regards, by the way.
Sir John.
The other day. And
his Sir John's the man. Sir John's the man. We communicate on Facebook, as people do these days. So, anyway, thanks for putting up with this crazy hour of food talk. I'm a little hectic. We don't usually do it this way. We'll be back, I guess, in September. We'll see. Liz has to bribe me with more pizza. She has to send me some emails with the new pizza menu. Yeah, whatever. All right, folks, be well. I'll see you at the end of the summer. If the gods be like, oh, and I wanted to say this thing, because I was watching this morning. Can I say this? Bitch, I'm Madonna. I had to say that. Did you see that video? Bitch, I'm Madonna. I had to say that. I had to say that, and I don't know why, because I read the Times today, and I watched the video, and Nicki Minaj kills it. Like, her 30 seconds in there, Nicki just eats that shit up. Anyway, on that note, sorry I cursed at the end. See ya in September. No, actually, more like October. Take care, folks. Bye.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.